64K. It makes DirectX calls, basically, and creates this beautiful piece of work. It actually goes on for about 3 minutes, constantly changing graphics. That weird bar you saw in the beginning was a metric ton of uncompression. So, what you're seeing right here is somewhere near the cutting edge of what we have now in what's known as the demo scene. But in actual point of fact, what we're going to cover here is not just, you know, what's going on right now, but where this all came from and why it exists. That slows down a 1 gigahertz machine. But anyway, you never get tired of those. So anyway, my name is Jason Scott. I run a site called textfiles.com. With me is Radman. Radman runs an art group called Acid. I don't know how many of you here know of the group Acid.
Woo!
Yeah. Everyone,
old school.
Hey everybody, thanks for coming out. Yeah.
I'll be good now.
no problem. All right, so basically, you know, the name of the talk is 100 Years of the Computer Art Scene. That was a marketing trick, but, you know, what are you going to do? You know, technology, as far as man has always approached it, incrementally over time, it's, you know, it gets better and better, but the biggest problem you have is adaption. How do you convince people that they were doing things this way and now they want to do it this way, and because your big metal honking, clanking thing is much better than, you know, however they were doing it by hand? And interestingly, if you really look at the history of communication technologies and later computer technologies, it's kind of actually surprising how much art actually plays a point into it. So in terms of this narrative, we're going to start somewhere around telegraphs, which is a little ways in, but what are you going to do? You know, telegraph technology basically involved using wires to send dashes and dots, indicating some sort of code that could be decoded over long distances, therefore allowing you to send messages basically instantaneously, an amazing difference for that time. You know, whereas before, you know, when Abraham Lincoln was elected, there were parts of the country that didn't know what their new president looked like for 3 or 4 months and didn't know he had won for weeks or months, simply because the communication wasn't there. So, you know, the addition of this instantaneous traffic changes the world markedly. In doing my documentary on BBSs, I had someone propose to me that, in fact, telegraphs are the first BBSs. And the reason why is because, you know, when you traditionally think of telegraph, you think of some guy with a little hat going dit 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 dit. But within a very short time, this is amazingly inefficient. I mean, the guy's not going to sit there with a code paragraph and just, you know, be reading it and doing this. What they do instead is when people come in to purchase their messages, they type in a message onto a little machine that produces a strip that has the dots and dashes, and this is what gets pulled through a machine that does the dots and dashes. In doing that, they end up creating a store and forward system. You know, basically you have a situation where you can have people buy codes in the middle of the day, and then overnight they just do it. Well, one of the side effects of that is that the young people who are running these stations send messages to each other during downtime, during the 2 a.m., 3 a.m. period. And since there's no star network in the way we usually think of it that makes it easy to go, say, directly from this part of California to Illinois, they end up having to pass it through other people. So people are agreeing to do this, and they are passing along this messaging system. Along with the telegraph comes the typewriter. And the typewriter is a really big deal because the typewriter takes away a portion of the printing experience away from professionals and puts it in the hands first of businesses and then of individuals. There's a semi-famous author whose name I unfortunately regret, but I do know the quote that upon gazing upon the first typewriter said, "Oh, all the poor novels that shouldn't have been written that will be written now." And the reason why is because it took away this little boundary. You know, you had to write something good enough that you could afford to go to a guy to turn it into a typeset book that could then be made into, well, now you can just write out your damn thing. And it's going to look the same. It doesn't matter. Well, it matters a little bit if you're typing at 2 in the morning versus, you know, 4 in the afternoon, but it's a misplaced letter as opposed to an illegible bird scrawl that you'll never be able to read again. So it's kind of interesting that, you know, in doing research, we found a piece of typewriter art. And there's a woman who this is attributed to, Ms. Flory. There are most likely earlier examples, but in the late 1800s, the 1880s, 1890s, she creates a butterfly out of a typewriter set. So basically what you end up with is you end up with this set of letters. Now, so what she has done is, instead of looking at it as a device for creating letters, she's looking at it as a device that you force the letters to instead become a piece of art. And this is a theme that continues on through the modern times, of taking this piece of equipment and saying, well, you know, it's cute that you make it do this. So what can I do with it? I think I'm going to make it do something it's not supposed to do, because that's much more amusing to me. I'm going to play you a piece of music. I'm not going to tell you what's making the music, but, you know, it's a piece of music. Let's see, up to here. Of course, you can all just watch the stupid thing.
Is that loud?
No. So what this is raindrops are falling on my head, being played by a IBM 1401 printer in the late 60s. This, you know, this is a, if you look at the screen, this is a unbelievably expensive printer to be doing this with. Obviously this is something you don't really want to be doing during work hours. It's, you know, it's costing them, you know, thousands of dollars. Who knows how long, how hard they had to work to figure out which keys created which noise. I'm pretty sure it's Daisy Wheel. This one is a little tougher to hear because they're trying to do chords, but it's theoretically the blue menu, but I don't buy in. If you listen for a while, it's, you know, you go, my God, it is the Blue Danube. It's this piece of work. So basically, in this cacophonous piece of crap, you suddenly, you know, discover that these guys, you know, and I mean, this thing was for this particular version of it. The printer came out in 1961. They did this in 1970, which tells you that maybe it was a little older, maybe it was a little bit, you know, it wasn't something that every department was trying to get their hands on. So, you know, of course, you have to assume this is some of the ugliest looking printing you can imagine. So, okay, we have, I mean, you know, there's everyone's favorite, you know, the classic computer picture. But what,
and you know, this is great, it's a laptop. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, this is really the phrase to me is just, you know, not just the size, but the importance that's applied to this technology, because it represents a major part of their budget. So the people who are creating this artwork, there you go, now it's kicking in. And when people after hours decide, I want to do something different with it, sometimes the projects they do become one of the only ways to justify these pieces of machinery. Unfortunately, I can't get it to...
Well, this concludes our recording session. See you next time.
One of the most famous situations of this is the Daisy song, which is played in... on IBM computer, 1940s, and it sings. I mean, it literally sings. Now, unfortunately, I couldn't. It was only in real media, so fuck them. But it was, it basically, but what really struck me at the time was it plays music for the first minute. Does not play. It doesn't come right out singing. It's got to play its, you know, chords. It's got to play, going, look, I can do the chords, and then in with the topper. You know, start singing on top of it. And then people who are looking at this going, oh, this is why we bought this machine. Because it's a $1 million machine that can sing. And that's, you know, and that's really the thinking behind it. Now, we have our other beautiful piece. You know, it's kind of sad in some ways. This is an Apollo. It's kind of sad in some ways because these kind of faked up, commercialized images of these old computers are often all that we have because they were the only ones allowed to come in with cameras and screw around. You couldn't just bring in your little crappy Polaroid Instamatic. So what you end up with is this very sterile, very clean, very strong sense that they're, you know, these precious little diamonds to be handled with kid gloves and not. But, you know, people don't do that when they're faced with a piece of technology. They go like, well, what happens if I jam this into here? So people will, you know, stick microphones where they shouldn't. People should, you know, I have a musician who I'm working with for my documentary. His name is Tree Wave. His music is pretty good. I might play the trailer at the end. But the music that he's making is being made using a, he's got a Commodore 64, an Atari 2600, a dot matrix printer, and another different kind of Atari, which he has in some ways, especially with the printer, he has soldered recording heads onto it so that the sound of the printer is what's being picked up. This ends up producing a rather interesting kind of fun sound, but probably not under Epson's original design. All right, so I'm going to move forward to the grand scheme of all things.
Oh, yeah.
Art-wise. When microcomputers start to come on the scene, this changes everything, right? Microcomputers made it so that the barrier to entry, you no longer, you know, in the early 70s, there was semi-serious talk of creating a license to use computers because at the time they were expensive, people's lives depended on them, so, you know, really, maybe you should go through an accreditation, maybe you should not be able to get on your first computer, you get your training computer, and then you move on, you know, I mean, that's where things were kind of heading. But then the Altair comes along, now anyone can buy one for hundreds of dollars, and everyone gets to buy one. Now, the big thing with the Altair, besides being one of the most successful examples, they needed to sell, I think it was 200 to be profitable. They didn't have any. They didn't exist. But they knew if they got 200 orders, they could afford it. They got 200 orders the first day and just went on from there. At the Homebrew Computer Club, where Stephen Jobs and Stephen Wozniak met, besides showing, they showed the Apple I. But one of the other demonstrations that was given there, which I do not have a recording of, was somebody figured out that his computer, which I believe was an Altair, gave off an unbelievable amount of RF frequency modulation. He figured out what bits to flip to make noise enough that it could play songs if you stuck an AM radio next to it. And so, now keep in mind, right, there's no way for him to save this. So he's got to be in the back, flipping away as fast as he possibly can during the meeting so that it's ready for people to look at. Because he has a way to save off all that program information. You know, and that's one of the other themes you see with a lot of artists, is they do an awful lot of work to achieve a thing. You know, I'm going to step away from It's a Boy and its classic sense. Just to move back, one of my original hopes had been, you know, seems to be a relatively interested crowd, but we always try to intersperse pornography as often as possible because it plays such a an important part in the world. So, you got to do what you got to do. During the ham radio period, hello there, hello Roxanne. It's been a while, Roxanne. Roxanne here probably dates to about the late 60s, early 70s. She's done using something called a remote teletype, which is basically a way to send text messages over ham radio, and basically any radio, but ham radio. And ham radio enthusiasts love this because they're on ham radio, and that's kind of fun. But within a short time, it's like, well, what else can we do? Well, we can kind of send data to each other. And they create RIDI art, and so you end up with Roxanne. Roxanne is not wearing much, I just want to point out, but Roxanne, you know, just wants to be friends. I talked to a gentleman named John Sheets, who ran the RIDI art contest. His compatriot has died, but he has not. He told me a little bit about the story of this, because after a while, they started to have contests in the early 70s. Who can make the best one of these? And who can make these particular graphics look the best? And then they would have a vote and see who would win. For some strange reason, this one also seems to be a nude. And so you can see we start to get some very interesting, you know, and, you know, obviously, I mean, I'm being pedantic, but yes, I mean, these are not characters that were designed for art. This is a person has to look, I mean, at some point an artist looks at it and says, well, this M, that represents this kind of shading in my mind, so I'm going to allocate it this way. And digitization is not, you know, as people later make machines that do art, people go, well, they must have always been that way, without really realizing that at one point it wasn't that way. John Sheets told me that the way they would do it is that they would, one guy he knew of, would actually take the Playboy centerfolds and put them into the printer of his Ritty, and then he just would look at it by eye, what was underneath the little square, and he would go, period. And he would type it, and then he'd do the next one. And this guy is hand-eye digitizing this piece of artwork. You know, this is an enormous amount of work. And at the end, he has a nude, so it actually works out okay. But one of the things that they later moved to is multi-sheets. So basically, you have a sheet and another sheet, and they've digitized or typed in this piece of artwork that you have to print out a bunch of Epson or line feed paper, and then cut off the margins and then attach them. And they end up with these beautiful, massive murals. This, again, is an enormous amount of work. But, you know, someone looks at that and goes, where do I buy one of those? You know, where can I get one of these pieces of work? So with the addition of the microcomputer, we moved to the consumer microcomputers. And with that, I'm talking, of course, of the Apple, the Atari, the Commodore 64. Now, here is an interesting situation, because now these computers are not just going into the hands of people. They're now being happily forced into the hands of children. And nobody has more endless capacity to waste energy than children. So, especially on porn. So, yes, so, you know, when you look at a piece of art as a kid, you know, you start out simple. You go with, like, letters. You try to make things look like you remember them, too. In the Apple world, this is where we seem to trace it back. In the Apple world, when people cracked a game, and by cracked a game, I mean, of course, removed the protection, they would, you know, the idea with cracking it was to be able to make it small enough to be able to transfer across a modem, because if it was the full disk, it would take forever, but if you knock it down to a small bit, that can mean the difference between a 5-minute transfer and a 50-minute transfer, and that's quite a bit when you're looking to get your wares. So the programmers who did this, the crackers who were able to go into the code, were pretty good at it, and they wanted to be proud of it. And so not only were they badass enough to go ahead and put up their own programs, but they were actually able to add their own introductory screens to their programs. What we see here, then, is the Apple crack screen, which starts out. And so, you know, tells you who it came from, special thanks to, you know, like it's a Hollywood production for this game. And so, and of course, call our bulletin board system. You know, here's an easily traceable phone number of the guy who cracked your game. It's not very long before they start moving into graphics. You know, it's not just going to be, well, here's our text, here's our stuff. It's going to be, you know, here's the wall, you know, you got the fire for Fahrenheit 451. Incremental moves, but it's coming, right? So then, when you start getting these kind of involved, and these are all circa 1982, 1983, these Apple screens are coming in. I don't have a lot of them here, but, you know, this is happening on the Commodore world as well. You know, the Commodore had a lot more graphics and sound than the Apple. It could do a lot more in that fashion. So groups who are cracking there are creating these things. Now, there's a along these different ones. Aren't those colors great? Aren't they the greatest thing in the world? The Arcade Boot Camp is a good example. Look at the fine palette of purple, green, and white that you have to choose from. Absolutely does his best, and how he kind of tries to fake out the brown at the bottom. So, again, it's cracked by the Penguin and the intern, and call this out poll at our number in Illinois. And again, the reason what you're seeing here is that on the Apple, you had monochrome and color monitors. The color monitor was kind of a hack, so it kind of didn't do things right. So a good artist who was doing work had to know what it was going to look like on both these screens. And in this case, you can see they do their best. It looks a lot better in monochrome. That kind of tells you which one the guy was working on. Now, around here, again, bunch of things. Obviously, in some of these cases, this is totally stolen, ripped art that they've taken from the game itself and put on just a few pieces of text. But somewhere around here... Oh, the Bitbiter. Okay, this is the one. I don't have an animation for it. You'll notice that this particular text here is kind of squelched along this side. The reason why is because it scrolls in. So this is kind of important because apparently still frames weren't enough. They've got to put in a thing saying, we cracked it. Our message is so important, we cracked it. Okay? This is the roots of what later becomes the demo scene, which Radman is going to talk to you about. Again, this is the genesis. What you have here is you have people who are justifying what they're doing by creating artwork. I mean, after a while, the guys who know how to shift bits are probably not the ones who know how to like get all the nice fonts in. It doesn't usually transfer over. Sometimes it does. You get a Renaissance man, but not often. So they end up having to give it to somebody, right? You end up with a division in your cracking group who does art. And that's, you know, why eventually these art groups go, why are we hanging around with a bunch of pirates? We could go solo. And they start creating artwork on their own and creating their own groups of nothing but art. This especially happens first in the Commodore 64, but later moves, you know, the Amiga is a really big one that causes this, where it's just, you boot up the disc and all it is them going, look at the graphic we did, look at the thing it's doing, look at the music we're playing. Music groups are, you know, split off as well, doing their music for art groups, and so on. The part that Radman comes into is something, a good example of where a piece of technology doesn't, it starts out with one idea and becomes something completely otherwise once you put it in the hands of people. And basically, there is something we call the ANSI standard. That's kind of a lie. There was a standard for VT100 terminals and for early terminals for cursor control, which there was a series of standards for what code could you send, mostly involving the escape key, escape, and you would create, you'd say, okay, this actually means make the cursor go back, so that way you could send it along the regular way. Well, this became a standard under the American National Standards Institute, ANSI. And it's ANSI standard number, huge number. You know the number offhand?
That's 3.64. Yep. 3.64.
Okay. ANSI 3.64. And so this tells you, okay, this code does this, this code does this, this code does this. Well, okay. Around the time that IBM comes out, the IBM PC comes out, and of course, you know, everyone was waiting for the PC to come out because they knew as soon as IBM came in, they would crush everything in their wake and that'd be the end of it. So it's kind of fun with these little candy-colored plastic boxes, but oh, here comes IBM screwed by. So they're all kind of watching this, right? And so it comes out. Now, whatever IBM implements wins, right? So IBM tapped a young, strapping, beautiful Microsoft to do a lot of their work in terms of the operating system. Along that way, as an extra bonus feature, you want to tell the story better than I, or?
Sure.
Sure, go ahead.
Let's go and bring it to the main.
Okay.
So yeah, around 1984 is when the Commodore 64 scene started to appear, and that's when we started to see what was going to later become the demo scene. People were creating these introductions, as Jason said earlier, that were elaborate displays of graphic artwork that were very similar to what you saw on the Apple II. And in some cases, the graphic art that introduced the, you know, that basically was the credit screen of the cracked game, the graphic quality of that was better than the game itself. And that carried on into the Amiga scene as well, where you'd start up the game and you'd load it up and you'd go, wow, this game looks really exciting. And then you actually start playing the game and you're like, wait, the cracked screen looks better than the game I'm playing. And this trend continued over to the PC as well. I can recall a game, Operation Wolf, cracked by the firm. And you look at the intro screen, and it's in a higher resolution than the game can actually play in, the intro screen. But yeah, around the mid-80s, people started to fool around with the ANSI medium, which was the standard method that people used to transmit colored characters and text on a BBS. So has everybody here pretty much used a BBS? Okay.
The one thing that is important to note, though, which I should have mentioned, was the addition of this ability to handle the control characters in the IBM is a complete strap-on, a complete, completely. Because what it is somebody, they implement a poor subset of this standard set. Call it ANSI.
Right.
And just, yeah, they extend it a little bit, they don't quite implement it correctly, and it's not default. You got to go out of your way to make it come on. So it's kind of buried underneath there. Like, you know, it's like when you find out that there's a command in Windows that's kind of like a Unix command, but they don't mention it anywhere and how it works. Kinda, except it doesn't. And with ANSI.sys, you had to say, when you boot up the machine, device equals ANSI sys, or it wouldn't even know how to deal with these characters itself. But once it did it, it becomes this, it does these cute graphic characters, of which are a subset, and which contain characters that don't exist in any other way, so you're not compatible with anybody. And they called it ANSI. You know? They just call it ANSI. This is kind of like why when people call CD-ROMs ISOs. Because it's short for ISO 9660. They just call it standards body. Standards. It's like picking up a, you know, something you do out of a rule book and calling it rule. It's just rule book. I'm doing rule book today. You know, that's, and that kind of tarnished, not quite great, you know, completely optional, who cares about it? We implemented it because somebody probably wanted it for some business customer. Just put this in and it'll work. We don't guarantee anything. Is the foundation that what Radman is going to mention to you is founded on. So just want that clear.
So, yeah, ANSI as a standard, the standard that we're referring to is X3.64. It was finally, I guess you could say, ratified in 1979. So, you know, it didn't take very long until people started to, you know, play with this medium and go, well, I can do more than just use this as a standard method for, you know, terminal control. And so people started to manually go in and take these codes and try and create artwork with it. And then the first program that there's any, like, that you can look back and find is actually called AnsiDraw. And that is what inspired Ian Davis to create his own software program that he thought, he saw AnsiDraw and he said, this program is lacking. I need to create something that's better. This sucks. So in 1986, he created the very first version of the Draw. And that's when different SysOps started creating these beautiful works of art that you can see here, such as this fine piece right here.
That's a template. That's the best part. It's actually blank, so you can put in your own announcement.
Let's see.
You know, for it's a boy, for you to spread with somebody.
Yeah.
Yeah, right here, right, yeah.
Doghouse VBS. And so people started to, you know, these were basically the introductory screens that you'd see when you'd first call a bulletin board. It would say, welcome to Gino's Place. And, you know, this was obviously, this was a collaborative piece of work here by Keith and Les. So as time went on, people started to send these pieces of artwork through message networks, such as FidoNet and WWIVNet, and then later WWIVLink, and different other, MetroLink, different other networks. And so then that was probably the very first start of the, I guess you could say, the ANSI art community. People started seeing these other pieces of work, and they would reply back, well, here's my latest piece of work, and they'd communicate that way. And eventually the SysOps of these boards created forums specifically for ANSI art that were dedicated to just nothing but ANSI art. And so then people stopped creating ANSI art that was just for a BBS, but then started doing stuff that was for just for the sake of drawing itself. Then in 1989, a group was formed called Aces of ANSI Art. And they were the first group, the first, you know, association of people to go, you know what, this, and by the way, this was on the underground scene of things. So everything that I've displayed so far is, you know, what you'd see on a standard bulletin board anybody could have access to. But I'm sure you guys all know, you know, back in the 1990s, it was really cool to be in a group. That was the cool thing to do. And if you couldn't get into a group, if you had no skills, then create your own group, right? I mean, why not? And so that's what these people did. They said, you know, let's, you know, I can't crack games and I can't code this. And I can draw ANSI, though. So I'll create Aces of ANSI Art. And so we started seeing that come along in 1989. And that, in turn, led to the formation of ACID. Members of Aces of ANSI Art eventually disbanded and formed a group called ACID in 1990. And so you can see, let's see, a couple early pieces. So, okay, Mr. Bill's Casino, that's not it. There we go. Okay. Now this is later. This is in the mid-90s. This was created by an artist, Kilohertz, and this is actually a combination. Now this is kind of tricky because it's an ANSI because it's using ANSI codes, But it's not what people would refer to as a traditional ANSI piece because it's using text characters and not the blocks. And that's kind of a an internal scene thing, but it is an ANSI. And if you zoom in here, you can see that these are all dollar signs.
It takes about 3 minutes to load over your...
Here, use the use him. So let me...
Okay. And so, yeah, this fine masterpiece here was created by Kilohertz, who was actually... he was a combination ASCII artist. He was primarily an ASCII artist, but he liked to color the ASCII art. So... Really, the difference is just a matter of semantics. They're pretty much the same thing. Now, at the same time that all of this was happening on the PC world, again, there were the people in the Commodore 64 scene in the mid. This predates all the ANSI thing. Going back a little bit, in 1984, these people that were creating all these cracked games and such on the Commodore 64 in Europe, they wanted to have a place to get together and trade all their games so they didn't have to mail them, because a lot of them weren't into freaking or, you know, doing that, so they would send out their discs through the mail, and they were called traders, and those were, you know, those that was eventually what was that eventually became swappers or couriers. It's all the same thing. And so they'd all gather together at this party, and it was basically a copy party. They would just trade wares all day. That's all they did. And
they were good times.
Yeah. And eventually, these people that were creating these elaborate pieces of work that were breaking off, not needing to create this artwork for the cracked games anymore, decided, well, why don't we start demonstrating some of the beautiful works of art and music and animation that we've done and show that off as well. And so the copy parties evolved into what is now known as the demo scene, the demo parties. And so people would come together and they would compete in all these different categories that they were proficient in. And so, you know, basically like the Farbrush demo that you guys saw earlier, that was a result of that. So I'm kind of jumping back and forth here a little bit. Let's see.
Hey, my wireless connection's on the board. Bitch.
Let's see. This is a good piece right here.
Okay, and it's good to point out, I mean, this is in fact text.
Yeah.
And what's going on here is here and today, in 9 milliseconds, we took a piece of text like this, loaded it in, shrunk it, and looked at it immediately.
Right.
Now, this text, which again, like we just said, is composed entirely of these ANSI characters.
And this would take a few minutes to load. If you call the bulletin board, and this was your welcome screen, you would just be like, in awe, sitting there, and it would take a good 2 minutes. It would go line by line.
And there's and again, these artists don't really have an easy functional way to look at this thing from a distance.
Right.
And this is basically what this kid is looking at right here, slowly creating these things. So later, when they started thumbnailing them and offering them up for download, sometimes these artists, this was the first time they were seeing them in that format. You know, oh, I guess it looked good.
Yeah.
And then sometimes you could see where their proportions were a tad off. And you ended up with some extremely rounded people. In this case, this is being done by some, you know, people who are relatively young. This is, you know, a piece of art, but it also tends to have information along the bottom in the same kind of text. This particular one doesn't have a lot of it because it's an opening screen. Glad to see you. You'll see also that it's got credits for the ANSI itself and who made the font. For whatever reason in this art scene, it becomes important over who creates which font and how interesting their font is. With some basis in graffiti, there seems to be some crossover between graffiti artists and letterers, and people want, you know, when Radman speaks of things like, what did he call it? He has a stupid name for it, like ANSCII.
Oh, ANSCII, the combination of ANSI colored ASCII.
Within a very short time, you've got to delineate yourself within this art scene. In other words, you have to come up with something, and you have two choices. Either one, draw better than everyone else, or two, draw pretty well as everyone else with an unbelievable limitation on yourself. Because then you go, well, yeah, I know it doesn't look as good, but I did it in my blood! And they're like, wow, that's pretty good. That's a pretty excellent little piece of work. So you end up with... Oh, this isn't... there. I've seen that one. That's boring. Where's our,
Which one?
I was looking for black and white.
Oh, that's that one probably, $4.95.
Here's a case where he's doing it in black and white, doesn't give himself any color information, and concentrates. The only thing he has now to delineate himself is shading. And I believe he only has 4 or 5 different...
He's making use of 2 grays and black.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's what he's got to work with. And so you look at it, once you realize this, and I mean, it's a case in art, sometimes you need the information that goes with it. Like, oh, that sounds pretty good. Oh, yes, but he did it using a calculator. Oh, then it's really good. This, you know, the actual use of the technology changes the quality of the art in your mind once you become aware of it. You know, because one of the problems that they have is, you know, you look at old movies and you're like, you know, well, I guess it looks pretty good. And then you realize, well, yeah, they did it with absolutely no electronic control. There was 3 days before they knew it even looked good. They had to shoot it on, you know, film that was of this quality. And then you say, well, now that's really something. You know, and in fact, you get to the point that the technology becomes so easy, they spend a lot of their time trying to emulate the flaws and mistakes of previous times. So, for instance, in a lot of music, a lot of rap music or dance music, you'll hear vinyl crackling, which is a complete fabrication simply to say, well, because in the old days we used a bunch of, you know, we didn't have the XJ5000 to sit here and do this kind of emulation, where we had to have records, so you make it sound like records.
Also, if you look at some of the earlier screens that were being drawn in the mid to late 80s, you'll notice that they're all, I mean, all these images are much longer. These are hundreds of lines long.
Why is it blurry?
Okay, so these are shaded blocks right here. So they're making use of 2 grays that you can see, one in here, and then these are, basically they're doing a hack on anti-aliasing with 3 shaded blocks that you have in ANSI. So this is like a combination of dark gray and light gray. So when you step back from it, it appears that it's another shade of gray that they really don't have.
Hackers. But the thing is, they're hacking using this, I mean, it's a different form of hacking. And you know, one of the side effects of this being a digital-based art is it's very simple to transfer, as opposed to, you know, once this person has created this, this is out there, right? They put it in front of something, they put it in front of a pack, and then it's got descriptions of what they were trying to do with it. Now it's out there. It's being transferred around. It becomes something people want. But, you know, it puts down a gauntlet. And you end up with these other groups who say, well, we can do that even better. But our name is this.
Nice.
And you get things like ICE, Fuel, Alive, Mestigris. You end up having these groups all with different interesting acronyms. Because ACID stands for ANSI Creators in Demand, which later, you know, has a rival in ICE, in Insane Creators Enterprises. And it's not until you have ICE and ACID facing off in this endless battle,
like the Bloods and the Crips,
you end up with this kind of a... you end up with this situation where, you know, they're going to make each other better. They're going to try to get members from each other. They're going to try to just do things, you know. So you know, and that's the kind of thing. And yes, and it does have a gangland aspect to it from a very safe, comfortable distance behind
you. Right. And a case in point on that, I mean, there were examples where people would guard their phone lists, and they would only give out certain artists' phone numbers to a set, exclusive, trusted group of people that they, a really elite group of people that they, you know, would trust with these phone numbers, because they were afraid that another competing group would call them up and try and recruit them into their group. And there were these wars, and you could see there's plenty of ANSIs where different artists are making fun of other artists in the opposing groups. And, you know, that it is. It's basically like any sort of competitive environment that you're in. That's what I think really inspired some of this artwork to come from what you saw with, you know, It's a Boy to what you see here. What I was saying earlier was that a lot of the earlier ANSIs that you see are much shorter in length. And the reason for that is they're 25 lines long versus the hundreds of lines long that you see here. The original ANSI editors, they didn't think that anybody would want to scroll text endlessly. You know, they weren't thinking in that way. And so the reason they were 25 lines long was that was how long your IBM PC could handle. It was an 80 columns by 25 lines long screen. And so it wasn't until the mid-90s people started to create ANSI editors to make these scrolling length ANSI, such as AcidDraw and then later PabloDraw.
It's worth noting that, in fact, It's good to know, because sometimes it's not known outside. A lot of people know of ICE or know of ACID because their stuff filtered up into the internet or filtered out into some bulletin board systems. But certainly by the mid-90s, there are literally dozens upon dozens upon dozens of groups who are aware of each other, who are creating things that make fun of each other, and there are other groups who are creating nothing but house organs, newsletters, and e-magazines that talk about what's going on in these other groups. You end up with this situation where there's an entire, literally a subculture, based somewhat on conflict, on one upmanship, and very important to the people that are in there. A level of myopia that seems almost incredulous, you know, if you're 5 feet back. You're like, you're all part of the same group.
Yeah, there were like ANSI and demo scene tabloids almost that would, you know, detail all the little conflicts that were ongoing between all the people involved. And these scenes were actually quite huge. There's thousands of different ANSI groups that have popped onto the scene in the last 14 years. And it's also noteworthy to mention, when these ANSIs first started coming out, they didn't have any sort of organized method of distribution. They were first distributed over the message networks, and eventually, SysOps would say, okay, I'll store 300 messages, and that's the cap. Anything, when I get 301, I'll delete the first message. So these things weren't being archived. These great works of art were just created, posted up on a bulletin board, and then when they'd cycle through, that was the end of their life. They weren't stored anywhere, so you could retrieve them later.
Stored in the artist's hard drive.
Well, yeah, and then you have a hard drive crash, and then you're screwed. So what happened was somebody suggested, why don't you start, instead of uploading these to message networks and uploading these to bulletin boards, why don't you start saving these in some sort of a package so people can download these later and view all of these ANSIs in their leisure. And so in 1992, the very first art packs were released. And that also kind of heightened the level of competition that there was between all of these different competing artists, because these things would get uploaded to all these bulletin boards worldwide and were showing up in places where people wouldn't maybe ordinarily see them. And they would go, they would see this art for the very first time that way.
Right. And they'd release them once a month with a header saying, this is the November 92 art pack, which would then become the December 92, which means you've got 1 month to come out with your next, and if you miss your deadline, the self-imposed deadline where you are literally calling up your artists, your band of people to say, I need the art in by the 15th because I have to make the pack ready for the end of the month. You've crossed into this other level of art. You're now working.
You're on the dark side now.
Yeah. You're working really hard to create this pack, which, again, from a distance seems rather easily dismissive. And I think you find here a lot of parallels to things like hacker subculture, where you might have a piece of code that needs updates. If it doesn't have updates, you start to look bad. Somebody else says, well, I can do it a little better than you. We changed the standard, and we can implement this better than you. And if you don't keep up with it, then you have people who are on your team. Now, it's not, because it tends to appeal to a slightly older group, you don't tend to have as... You have territorialism, but you don't have just the pure... this program version does not, in its info file, immediately say, this other program bites, cock, totally blows. If you use it, you will get an unbelievable amount of cancer from this thing. The source code, you have it, right? One of the most interesting, again, this is a side thing, but one of the most interesting things that I found out about ANSI art that I didn't know before was that sometimes these guys would put comments in black text on a black background into these. And only if you step through them would you see the message where they were making fun of the other groups. Otherwise, it would scroll by and no one would be the wiser. So you kind of had to now go through these 100-line pieces of art and kind of look for what they kind of tucked away for you. That's the kind of level of depth you find in this, real interesting, deep kind of thing. All right, so I'm going to... Was there any other aspect of this you wanted to?
Drinking.
No.
Okay, excellent. All right, in that case, once again, keeping to the theme I promised, where are we switching to?
Porn.
Excellent.
Nice.
I'm going to play you...
Always a crowd.
We're going to play you Candytron, which was one of the top demos in 2003 by the same group, Farbrausch. Farbrausch has been kind of dominating things lately.
Germans dominate.
Again, this is a 64K program. Has music, has sound, has synthesized voices, uses DirectX to do what a lot of its trickery, but, you know, is an impressive piece of work. And anyway, so I hope you've gotten a different idea on all of this subject. And again, this is an ongoing project for myself with artscene.textfiles.com. Radman has actually gone out of his way last couple of years, worked on collecting a few gigabytes of ANSI art, which he has for sale here. If you wish to have an acid beanie, this is the time to get one, please. You can easily get it. And again, we, you know, just encourage you, you know, take another look at these kind of old scenes, because they're the ones you want to be a part of. So thank you very much, please. Everyone's just in silent awe waiting for the porn. Where's the girl?
Porn.
That's what the internet is for.
It's loading.
That one faster.
That's including the sound, the music, and the voice that's singing here. I had the opportunity to watch a small documentary on Fabrash. They got a little bit of news. They actually wrote the program, the product, doesn't look too much unlike 3D Studio, and says, do this here, make this happen here, and they're constantly adding to it to add new effects. Parties are now extremely popular. You have demo parties like Assembly, located in Finland, which has an average of 5,000 attendees. They actually rent out a stadium for it. The Gathering is also very similar. Many thousands, 4,000 attendees. You know, it's a really huge thing. It's got a whole, you know, I don't know what you'd call it. It's got a whole, it's almost a sporting event. And every year they have competitions. They have demo competition, 64K demo competitions, 4K demo competition. You have freestyle music. You have a music writing composition. Basically, these are all things where they're putting artificial limits on people's art to try to force them to have to rethink it. Because if they're let loose and they do have the freestyle, you know, the full demo competition, you end up with 16 megabyte demos, which have a lot of pre-recorded stuff. But there's something still very interesting, magical about the fact that someone did this in 64K. Oh, that's one thing that should be pointed out. This is a 64K demo with a 20 megabyte library.
Oh, come on!
DirectX. No, I mean DirectX. A purist would say you can't use DirectX. You see, in the early days of demos, they didn't have floating point. They had to do floating point on the fly for these things to get cut. You know, so when a curve went by, that was a big deal. Anyway, hope you've enjoyed it. Thank you very much.